I think I'd rather die in nuclear war than go to Olean.
Penn State was in the Atlantic.
Tired. Mark Whipple was a bad coach at UMass. Wired. Charlie Molnar was a bad coach at UMass. Inspired. Kevin Morris was a bad coach at UMass.
All right, good evening. This is Critic Sage coming to you live, New York City. Right now it's about 12:45 a.m. I'm real tired. I recorded an absolutely outstanding 90-minute interview with Walt Bell, the football coach of the University of Massachusetts. I don't have much else to say besides that. The Freddie Riley episodes we did last week, we are going to get them out soon. I got to figure out how to do it. It's like 3 hours. It's fun. It's great. I got to figure out how to chop them up, so bear with me on that. For now, enjoy Walt Bell. He cares a lot about doing well at UMass, and I was quite surprised with just how much I enjoyed it. I thought I'd enjoy it, but I appreciate what the guy's trying to do, and I think he contextualized a lot of the challenges last year and really made the best of this opportunity, and I want to thank him for coming on the show. So enjoy that. The program is, of course, brought to you by the fine folks at Five College Movers. World-class moving, stress-free in the Pioneer Valley and beyond. Five College Movers, call Pat and the gang. Tell them I sent you. Move, don't move, but use Five College Movers, whatever you do. I guess you wouldn't use them if you didn't move, but you know what I'm saying. Enjoy the episode, and then there's a fun mailbag that's weird and winding and twisted at the end. Peace.
This girl from my past had ridiculous ass. She attended UMass and she passed every class. Walked down the hall with a stuck-up sass. Talk to basketball players. She liked how they passed. But when I used to hit it, the ball catch, she quit it. She wouldn't admit it, but shorty was addicted.
You know, there was a reporter who covered UMass, I think, for one season. And I think it happened to be the first or second season of UMass in the FBS, which was the only person who would enjoy that would be a reporter, because there was a lot of interesting storylines swirling around a new program, new coach, the whole nine. And he once told me, he was a little bit of a showman. He was a Mizzou guy. And young kid at the time, but you know, he had a little bit of a panache, a little flash to him. And he said college football coaches are, and he was referring to Division I college football coaches, are the most paranoid people in America. And it stuck with me. That line always stuck with me. Because years later, somebody once said that the reason people in the profession don't love Steve Spurrier is because he's the only guy who doesn't act like the most paranoid person in America. I'm paraphrasing a little, but basically that Spurrier was kind of the old ball coach, and the knock was from his critics was that, you know, he coached 3 hours a day, did his thing, and he was out of there in a world filled with paranoid sociopaths. You're in the profession. You have to be aware of these sorts of stereotypes that surround someone who does what you do. You're a young guy who rose fairly quickly. Are you, Walt Bell, a paranoid guy?
I wouldn't say paranoid. You know, I think, as with all things in life, you got to be choose. You know what you're, I mean, at the end of the day, as a head football coach, you got to do what's best for your program at all times. And at the end of the day, that's got to manifest itself in two things. You know, you doing an unbelievable job taking care of your kids and making them better human beings, and then winning football games. Those are the two main things. And there's a million ways to do that. You know, Coach Leach and Coach Spurrier don't coach a lot. You know what? And they've won a lot of games. There's guys that grind. I mean, life changing, life ruining. You know, I mean, just amount of hours that people work. You know, there's a million ways to do it. You know, I mean, at the end of the day, as long as you run a good program, you take care of your kids, you invest in your kids, you make your kids' lives better, you impact lives, you win football games. There's a million ways to do it. We just do it the way that we do it.
So that's a perfect segue. So what is the way you do it? Because culture is the most important thing. You hear about it all the time. Everybody says it, but it's also for outsiders who aren't, you know, there day to day. It's also the most overused term.
Oh my goodness, you're not kidding.
In college athletics, and you know it's important, but you know what is culture? What is how do you build that program, and what does culture look like to Walt Bell and his staff?
Okay, well, I mean that is a. The word has been used. I mean, the word culture is probably the most overused word in sports. I mean, the greatest sports psychologist on the planet will tell you if you win games, you have great team chemistry. If you lose games, you have bad team chemistry. Team chemistry has no influence whatsoever on winning and losing. You know what I mean? So culture, chemistry, a lot of those things, probably especially today, you know, with all the corporate jargon that has – jumped into athletics, you know, synergy and you know just all the ridiculous stuff that you hear, but you know, to me, I think, you know, we're really based on three things, and this is just a lifetime of working for 7 or 8 different head coaches, playing for 2 different head coaches, being around great people, being around in the middle people. You know, for me, we're really based on 3 things. You know, we want to do 3 things as a program at a really high level. And number one for us today is communicate. Okay. We want to communicate incredibly efficient, incredibly clear. We want to communicate in a way that's respect, you know, I mean, just communication. Okay. That is number one. How we teach, how we talk, how we instruct, how we deal with our players, the relationships that we build with our players, efficiency, effectiveness, just number one is communication. Okay? And that's something that we talk about every single day. It's something that we make ourselves do as a staff, something we make our kids do. And I know that sounds really rudimentary, but I've been a part of a lot of programs that don't do that at a high level. Okay? Number two is clarity. Everything that we do, we want to make sure that we're as succinct as possible, that we use as few words to make as much impact as humanly possible. And that, really, at the end of the day, that affects how we teach, you know, how we coach, how we meet, how we give instruction, the expectations that we have for our players on and off the field, the expectations that we have for them in their social life and their academic life. But, you know, just great communication. Okay, and that doesn't mean just as many words as you can possibly say and, you know, repeat, you know, play the game, repeat and all that stuff. But number two is we want to communicate with great clarity, okay? And those, honestly, those have to be worked on every single day. Those are something that we emphasize and, you know, is parallel in every aspect of our program, academics, strength and conditioning, their physical life, their spiritual life, their academic life, all those things, okay? And then number three is the hardest, and that's consistency. Okay, and that's the ability to do it every single day, the ability to do really ordinary things at an extraordinary level. And those are really the three things that, after being here for 15 months, that we have really tried to make sure permeate themselves through our program. And so, again, just communication, clarity, and consistency.
And how do you, I guess, tangibly, like, manifest these? You obviously do them, but you say you work on them every day. Are you and your staff, are you, like, literally at the end of the day, do you look, you know, not look in the mirror, but do you sit down and say, okay, did I, you know, how do you assess whether or not those things are getting across?
Well, yeah, I think standards and practices, that's always with everything, you know, everything in life. How can we tangibly measure? How can we tell that this is working? How can we tell? All right, just really quick example. When I took the job the year before I got there, there were 140 something tutor misses. Okay. Scholarship athletes not showing up for tutors. Okay. Small example. In 14 months, we've had 12. In our first season here, we had 7. Okay. Part of it is just we're going to communicate how important that is, and we're going to make it really clear what the expectations are and what the consequences are going to be if you don't. You know, and we're going to emphasize it, and we're going to get what we want, you know, which is, number one, our kids performing at a high level academically, okay? And then number two, when you don't, we're going to go correct that. You know what I'm saying? I mean, just how we,
you know, we're going to communicate that. It's going to be very clear what the expectation is. There'll be a consequence if you don't, you know, which ultimately leads to consistency, which is, you know, four straight semesters, you know, when final grades come out May 12th of highest team GPA in the history of the FBS era, you know, and that, you know, academics are a small piece, but to me, and then obviously standards and practices, you know, every two or three months, you're really going to go through and say, all right, guys, this was important to us. Where in the organization are these things struggling? Whether it be recruiting, whether it be communication between the offense and defense on recruiting certain prospects at certain positions, you know, but every two or three months, you're going to get together in an organization. You're going to talk about those things and make sure that we are doing what we say we're going to do, that we are being consistent.
How do you get the philosophical buy-in from, I mean, is it when you're interviewing candidates for the staff, because it starts with your staff, I would assume. Do you explain to guys, like, look, this is how these are the non-negotiables for me. I need these three things. And if you don't buy into that philosophically, if you think it's a little corny, if you prefer to emphasize something else, maybe this isn't the right fit for you. I mean, how do you sell your staff on that so that it becomes something that just sort of is osmosis and sticks with the entire culture?
Yeah, I think that's two parts. You know, the first part, you know, is kind of in hiring, you know, because I think one of the best things that's ever happened to me in my career was GA to three or four different places, you know, coach for different head coaches, different ways, million ways to skin a cat, which, you know, kind of alluded to earlier, a lot of ways to win football games. And a lot of times you see people hire reputations or hire guys with the ego. You know, to me, it was really important when I first took this job and we kind of knew, hey, look, you're going to show up. There's 59 scholarship players left. There's probably only going to be 52 when you get there because of some, you know, whether it be academics or social behavior or whatever, get a bad APR score. You know, we knew when we took this job that there's going to be a lot of work to do. You know, and to fix that, there's only one way to fix that, and that's to go to work, you know, and it's going to take a lot of like-minded, egoless, selfless, hardworking people with chips on their shoulders. It's going to take an incredible amount of energy. So number one, just on the front end, I wanted to hire really young, really ambitious, really aggressive, you know, like-minded people, you know, because again, when you have backgrounds and personal experiences with the people that you hire, you know that you care about each other regardless of the job. That makes getting through the hard times that I knew we were going to go through, you know, in the very, you know, the very early tenure of the job, is going to make that a lot easier to handle. So on the forefront, making sure you're hiring like-minded people that you believe in. Because when you go through tough times, again, it's a lot easier to believe in the people around you. On the second part, you know, just from a how do you talk about it every day. You emphasize it every day. You know, I mean, in every single day, whether it be in, you know, your 6:30 a.m. staff meeting, you know, whether it's your special teams meeting with the players at 2:30, whether it's a position meeting, whether it's on the practice field, whether it's in the weight rooms, in the, you know, in the classroom, academically, whatever it may be, there's going to be a million opportunities where poor communication can show its head, you know, whether somebody didn't say something, you know, as clear as humanly possible or as succinct as possible. So a kid thought this when it really was this, or somebody just not having the toughness physically or mentally to just grind through it every day. When you've said run through the line 9 million times and somebody doesn't do it, that you've got the toughness to say it 9 million of one, you know? So I think it's just, you get what you emphasize. You know, and we're going to talk about it every day, and we're going to do the best we can to do it every day.
So that's like the universal philosophy, and I think it makes a lot of sense into sort of simplifying how to run what is really a very complex organization in terms of a Division I college football program. I think people don't always appreciate the number of moving parts, the number of dynamics that are at play, the uniqueness of each school and each program. But in terms of going into the specifics now that kind of fill in the bones of that philosophy, I'm curious, a lot is made of the, let's talk, you know, of the culture of New England football, and you're a guy from the South and those regional dynamics. And so what did you have to learn, or what did you learn in the first year that has informed the way you drive that culture in terms of how you get kids specifically? So I don't know if I'm being clear enough. I should probably work on my clarity as a principal.
Well, no, from a recruiting standpoint or just from a programmatic
standpoint? Recruiting and staffing.
Okay. I'll go from the recruiting piece first. From a recruiting, I am from Memphis or Dixon, Tennessee. Spent the majority of my life in Dixon, Tennessee, about 30 minutes outside of Nashville. Pretty much, if you go from Memphis to Nashville on the interstate, you go through it and don't know you're there. Okay, so I come from a little small town, kind of in the middle of nowhere. I've been in Oklahoma. I've been in Mississippi. I've been in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. I've been in Washington, D.C. I have been everywhere, and everywhere that we have been and staffs I've been on, you learn really quickly that recruiting is about relationships. It's about, it's about being authentic more than anything else. Recruiting, I mean, truly, recruiting is about relationships. It's probably a little cliche, but recruiting is authenticity. You know, it's the ability to be okay being you, because when you're not you, the people that you can recruit, when they tell it's an act, when they can tell it's a game, that is death in recruiting. So number one, I think authenticity is the most important thing. You know, one of the best recruiters I've ever been around, when I was at the University of North Carolina, he was the most un-North Carolina person ever, okay? But he was authentic. He was true to himself. He had a great personality. He worked at it every single day. He was a great relationship builder. But this authenticity, I think, is huge in recruiting and managing a position group. So number one, I think that's much more important than where you're from or who you know or what relationships you have. You know, because a lot of the relationships that you're going to build in recruiting, the only way you earn those is through time. And that's the only way that you build trust. You know, and when you recruit in an area for 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, you know, or however many years, you know, and so there's no other way to make that up other than accrued time and working, you know. And so for me, here's what I knew when I took this job, you know, and part of the reason why I was really excited to take the job, first about the university, you got top 20 public school in the country or top 25 public school in the country. You got Eisenberg Business and Management. You got Sports Management. So you've got one of the top 10 pre-professional schools on your own campus. You got number one on-campus dining in the country. So from an academic standpoint, you kind of check all boxes. From what they're going to eat when they're on this campus, our ability to grow and mature our kids from a nutrition standpoint, you can check that box. From brand new football facilities, 4 or 5 years old, with Ryan and the support that I've got since I've got here, we've been able to add to some of the things in the weight room, add to the nutrition components. So we've got great facilities, great academics, great facilities, great food. So we've got everything that we need to recruit. And then what I was really excited about the job is from New York City to Washington, D.C., there's huge population density. There's great basketball, which means there's great athletes. Football is growing and improving leaps and bounds. There are great football programs from D.C. to New York City. Okay. So you got great population density. And again, not a ton of great G5 options. Okay. And so I felt like with all that we had to sell on recruiting, from New York City to Washington, D.C., great population density. And then between my time in Maryland, guys on my staff that have recruited up the East Coast before at other places, I felt like this was a great opportunity for us in recruiting, and I think it manifested itself in our first field recruiting class.
So the authenticity of what you're selling in terms of the personalities on staff, I totally get, and what you're selling on campus, I totally get. But you also have to, when you're being authentic, you have to be honest about the challenges that kids are going to face when they come here, which is to say that they haven't won in a while. I mean, it's
they haven't won more than 4 games in the FBS.
Right. And
not in a while, it's ever.
And right.
That's exciting. you know, not only are you going to leave here with a great degree from one of the top 25 public institutions in the country, you're going to train in great facilities, you're going to stay well, you're going to live well, you're going to have a great camp experience, and you're going to have a chance to do something that's never been done before in the history of FBS football and institution, to create history, to leave a legacy. You know, and to me, that's the picture that we paint. You know, and again, that's exciting. You know, to me, there's a fortune favors the bold, and it will always be that way. You know, and it just so happened that I was the one young enough and dumb enough to take this job, you know, because I was so excited for the opportunity. Because to me, every job's a bad job until you make it a great job. I remember when I was growing up, Buffalo and Eastern Michigan were suicide jobs. And look at what's happened to those places. You know, and to me, I was so excited because, again, unbelievable academics, great facilities from a football standpoint. I mean, our football facilities are better than anything I had at Southern Miss or Memphis or Arkansas State when I was there. Okay, now Arkansas State's built some great stuff since I left. So we've got unbelievable facilities, great academics. We can grow them. We have great recruiting footprint, huge population density, and we've got a chance to do something that's never been done before somewhere. Like, it doesn't get any better than that. You know, so to me, from the point of painting the picture, that's our job, you know. And so if we can continue to paint that picture, get kids as excited, you know, about this program as we are as a coaching staff, I think we've got a chance to make a big mark here.
Are you authentic with kids in terms of how you explain the challenges in terms of, I mean, obviously in terms of winning and losing, we know, but I think 16, 17, 18-year-old kids, I mean, I think their conception of FBS football and then the reality at a lot of places, not just UMass, it's not unique to UMass, is very different, especially when you're not winning. I think everybody sees, you know, Alabama and Tennessee and whoever's, you know, Tennessee's probably not a great example right now, but they don't necessarily realize that, you know, it's not all hunky dory, all, you know, from jump. And how do you explain that to kids? Like, look, when you come in here, you know, McGurk's not going to be sold out. But guess what? When they were an FBS team, they were selling that place out for FBS games when they were good. So the people will come. I guess from a kind of a selling, because like I'm a big believer that UMass football is, it will absolutely draw fans and be a legitimate, you know, a thing to do in the area once they start winning. It's always been that way. And that's I'm not saying that's a good thing, but it's just a reality. How do you explain to kids that sort of the buzz of, I mean, you walked into a hockey game, I think your first time on campus, it was a sold out place, you know. I mean, so like, how do you explain that? Because right now I think it's got to be very hard to explain to kids what it could look like here.
I don't necessarily feel that way. You know, like, to me, it's not hard to explain. I mean, again, from Washington, D.C. to New York City, a lot of those places are pro sports places. You know, I've been at the University of Maryland when there's 10,000 people in the stands. I've also been there when it's sold out and there's 69,000 people hanging from the rafters. I've been in North Carolina when there was nobody. You know, we were playing for the Coastal Division Championship our first year there in 2013, but we had the bowl band. You know, we inherited the bowl band. There are more Virginia Tech fans there than Carolina fans. So, like, I've seen it, you know. Seen a lot of folks, little folks, you know, been in the Sun Belt Conference USA. But I think, again, kids have a great understanding because they're competitors. When they watch basketball games, they want to watch the Warriors play. They want to watch LeBron James play. Why? Because they're winners. You know, and to me, it's making sure that you're recruiting the right type of kid that understands, number one, that understands this place, that is a whole part kid. That wants a great academic experience. You know, I mean, that's what we've got to do. We've got to become, you know, the Stanford, the Northwestern of the G5, because there isn't another one. You know, and
that's a really good sell right there. That's the best thing you said so far.
You know, and to me, that's what we've got to be. We've got to make sure in the recruiting process, number one, you're recruiting the right type of kid that's excited about this place. Because why choose UMass? Again, for all the things that I've been saying for the last 20 minutes. Unbelievable education. By the time these kids graduate from the University of Massachusetts 5 years from now, it'll be a top 15 public school in the country. Okay? So you're getting a great degree from a great public institution. Okay? You are going to, if you have the right mindset, if you
you're a believer like I am a believer, okay, we're going to do something and win at a level that's never been done here in the history of this football program, okay, at this level, at the highest level of football. So you got a great degree, I'm going to play unbelievable football. And then from a life after football standpoint, 260,000 living alumni. I mean, if you just look at the names and the places that the CEOs of this place, I mean, so huge alumni base for life after football, unbelievable internships when you're here. So academics, athletics, oh, by the way, when you're here, you have the number one on-campus dining in the country, okay, training great facilities, and when you're done here, you're going to have a great degree from a quality institution that can help you for the rest of your life. I mean, to me, that's a much better recruiting pitch than a lot of the places that I've been.
Well,
you know, and to me, it's, as long as we're recruiting the right kid that wants those same things for himself, it's a whole part person, we're going to succeed at a high level.
Well, the thing about the G5, I think that was the thing that stuck out with me is I always think, like, and I don't need to denigrate other institutions on this program, but the reality is, you know, there's a lot of MAC schools and there's a lot of schools in the G5 that just don't have the national cachet that UMass does. And I don't think and I'm always sort of like, why would a kid go to some of those places when he could come here? And I think that there's been a perception in the past like, oh, we'll beat out low P5 schools for kids who maybe didn't want to, you know, wanted to play right away or whatever. And I think sometimes that's actually there's been a few kids in recent years, but in the last 4 or 5 years who fit that mold and then didn't actually turn out to be, you know, all that good at UMass. Whereas the kids who were really good are kind of like Chris Peterson at Boise used to call them. They call them OKGs, our kind of guys. And what is your OKG? Like, what is the prototypical kid you're looking for, and how do you figure out that that's the guy who, you know, fits the mold?
Yeah, you know, I mean, for, you know, obviously there are physical metrics to doing any job. You know, I can want to be the center for, you know, the Boston Celtics as much as I possibly want to be, but I don't have the genetics to do so. You know what I'm saying? So there are physical metrics that are requisite to playing this game at the highest level. To me, we look for four things, okay? Tough, smart, resilient, overachiever. Okay? Tough, smart, resilient, overachievers. Okay? Toughness. Mental and physical toughness. You know, and toughness is a, whether it's toughness in background, whether it's toughness in the choices that you've had to make or the sacrifices that you've had to make, the physical toughness required to play the game. Just toughness, you know. And so in all the leading questions that we're going to ask high school coaches, that's one of the things on the forefront. We watch tape. That's one of the things that we want to see, you know, tough. Okay. Smart. I mean, obviously we're at a top 20 public institution in the country. One of the reasons that we're in the scholarship predicament that we are is they signed 76 guys in 16, 17, and 18. There were 36 left when I got the job and 34 as of now. And the majority of those are kids that were casualties academically, which is why our APR was in the situation that was in. So we've got to be smart, you know, and not only do we have to be smart academically, but we've got to be smart in the decisions that we make. You know, we've got to make sure that we're doing a great job of recruiting to UMass, that our kids love UMass, that they want to stay here. Because understand, when, you know, as all these rules and restrictions get passed about transfers, we've got to make sure we're recruiting kids that love UMass because they want to fit in at UMass, that they're a great fit for us. You know, they're not the first sign of trouble. They're not looking to leave. So number one, tough, smart, resilient. Okay. People that have been told no. People that have had to overcome. People that have had to handle adversity in their life. People that we see from a personality standpoint handling adversity. Okay? Getting coached a certain way. Getting coached hard. Being demanded of at a high level. Kids are going to be able to handle that. It requires great resiliency. Okay? And then overachievers. Guys that we feel like their best football is when they're 21 and 22, not when they're 18. You know? Guys that are going to develop and grow and improve. every year. You know, and so for us, from a mental makeup standpoint, that's what we're going to try to find every year. Tough, smart, resilient, overachievers.
Are those mantras like literally on the blackboard in your office, or is it just kind of understood?
No, I'm not a big put a bunch of dumb slogans on the wall. Obviously in recruiting, we're going to have those conversations. You know, we're having to make tough choices about who's going to be on the roster. Why do we want this kid as opposed to this kid? When you get to the point where you've got to start making tough choices, our staff are going to have to prove that about the young man they want to stand on the table for.
So you've been a lot of places. I mean, you've been around a lot of different types of places, G5s, P5s, you know, big, you know, national championship caliber programs, really small programs. I want to ask you a little bit about your influences. I know Blake Anderson
Blake Anderson
at Arkansas State, and you've alluded to him a lot. But this doesn't even have to be someone that that you coached under or played for, could be. But who's informed your program building philosophy? As well as, and also your coaching philosophy, like sort of X's and O's wise, who's informed that those things a great deal for you, and kind of like what I guess philosophical schools of thought and culture building do you build on? You come out of?
I was really fortunate. Obviously I played at Middle Tennessee under Andy McCollum my senior year. Coach Stocks was hired, went to the first bowl game in the history of Middle Tennessee State football. From there, Louisiana Lafayette with Ricky Bussell, Memphis, Tommy West, the offensive coordinator at the time was Clay Helton, now the head coach at Southern Cal. Oklahoma State with Coach Gundy, Bill Young, who's the coordinator at the time, to Southern Miss, Larry Fedora, Carolina, Larry Fedora, Blake Anderson, Arkansas State, DJ Durkin of Maryland. I think, and the reason I say all that's not just to waste time and ruin your podcast, but every place you go, there's going to be great things about that job. There's going to be things that you're going to want to replicate and repeat. And then every job that you take, there's going to be things that you don't like. And I think kind of on everybody's journey to becoming a head coach or the path to becoming a head coach, it's your ability to kind of, what fits your personality, what fits, what you believe in, what fits kind of what your goals are as a human being and as a professional, and kind of make it your own. Every place that I was at, you learn something different. Tommy West, we were, 9-to-5, old school, it was just, old school ball. But with Coach West, now everything was super laid back. It was basically banker's hours, 9-to-5. Coach West went to 4 bowl games in the first, he went to the first like 4 bowl games in the history of the program in 40 years. Coach West won there in a way that nobody had before, and it was basically 9-to-5. But those 2 hours of practice every day, it was 4th and inches and you didn't get it every day. Practice was a war every day. Just the emphasis on, we only see the players for these 2 hours of practice. You got to go coach your team. That's John Calipari. You got to coach your team. When I was GA at Memphis, Calipari was upstairs on the second floor. Clay helped his relationships with the players. When I was at Memphis, Clay was the guy, every single guy on offense, they were to die for Clay. And then Oklahoma State with Coach Gundy, I think Larry Fedora is probably, obviously won a lot of games at Southern Miss, inherited the bowl band program in Carolina when we were there for those first 2 years. Larry ended up taking North Carolina to the championship game, and going 12-1 or 11-1 that year. Larry was just an incredible organizer, incredibly efficient, so well run, so well organized. Blake Anderson at Arkansas State, just the way he treated people, the way he treated staff, his investment in the players outside the white lines. There's great things at every place. There's things that you don't like at every place. And it's just your ability to, what fits your personality and your goals and what you want, out of football for your players.
at what point do you think you knew you were ready to run your own team? I mean, I think it's easy for guys to, it's certainly easy for fans to say, you know, I could do this, I could do that from afar, and you're, you know, one aspect of the game. But there's so much, as you just alluded to, and all those guys, you alluded to different aspects. So all of those guys were informing your philosophy. But at what point do you say, you know what, I think I know kind of what I would want my program to be. And then once you got it at UMass, were there surprises that you said, ooh, this is just something I had not foreseen?
You know, just to answer the first part, kind of when, I mean, I don't think anybody, I mean, well, there are, but, you know, I don't think there's anybody intellectually, like, arrogant enough to say, oh, I was ready at this day, or, you know, I've always been ready. I mean, we all may feel that way, you know, but had a chance, you know, I've had 3 or 4 chances to take head coaching jobs. And to me, I don't think there ever is, you know, having watched guys win conference champions, you know, I mean, since my senior year in college, which would have been, in 14 years of college football, I've been to 12 bowl games, been a part of like 3 or 4 conference championships. So I've been really fortunate. I've been nothing around but really successful programs. And I don't think either, you know, I don't think any of those head coaches, there was ever a moment where like, yep, I'm ready. Or there wasn't something that didn't come up that wasn't new, you know, where you didn't have to just, you know, use your gut and how you feel and use what's true to you and what's important to you as a decision maker. But I've had, you know, I had 3 or 4 choices to become a head coach. But the most important part of picking a job or saying yes to a job, you know, is to make sure that you're confident in that job and that job and that place can have success, you know, and making sure that, you know, what your strengths are as a recruiter and developer and, you know, from a system standpoint, offensively and defensively and special teams, that you feel like that you can have great success, you know, at that place, you know. And I think for me, this was the first one that I really felt super confident that with all the aforementioned things, like I said, you know, academics, footprint, all that, you know, I truly felt like we could build something really special here, you know. And so I felt like that this was a risk, you know, that it was very much worth taking. Because taking a head coaching job is what it is. It's a risk, you know, because every single guy that takes a head coaching job, they think that, you know, they're going to build a great program, win tons of games, and everything's going to be great. And, you know, it doesn't have problems. It's too competitive of a business. But number one, I just felt like that this was, you know, that, you know, at some point in your life, you get tired of working for other people and you feel like this is a great opportunity and let's go make it work. And, you know, so number one, I just felt like this is the right opportunity. You know, number two, you know, I don't, you know, from a was there anything that really surprised you standpoint? You know, I mean, I think on the front end, you know, especially with what, you know, it was, you know, very well explained to me in the vetting process about what our issues were going to be in the near future. We knew that there was going to be an incredible amount of work to do. My staff knew that there was going to be an ungodly amount of work to do. And so I kind of felt like coming in, we knew, you know, that there's a lot of work, you know, complete overhaul and reconstruction, and that's what we're here to do, and we're excited to do it. So nothing surprising when, you know, on the front end, you know that there's going to be a lot of issues along the way.
And when you got here, was there a moment, were there moments throughout, I mean, look, let's just be honest, it was a really hard season. I mean, and we, you know, fan base kind of knew that was coming, and I think everybody sort of understood that, but...
Yeah, there's a reason every publication in the country picks dead last. So.
You gave us a lot of points, you know? I mean, let's got to call a spade here a little. So in those moments, I mean, you know, I mean, there's naysayers, there's doubters, there's all, I mean, maybe those things fuel you, but is there a moment in, you know, mid-November where you're just sitting there in the office one morning and you're just kind of like, man, this is tough? Or, I mean, like, how does that sort of play out? How do you process the losing? It's challenging.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, it's not very healthy, you know, but anything worth doing is worth overdoing, you know, and all the suffering, all the miserable,
all of the everything that you go through as a coach, everything that those players had to go through. I mean, to me, the most important thing, especially because we knew they were going to be a lot of hard times. I mean, I've told our team, you know, I mean, we knew as a coaching staff probably on our second or third spring practice, wow, there's going to be problems. But at the end of the day, that's not how you build a program. I mean, to me, the tougher part is every single day that you come to work, finding a way to be positive, finding a way to build our kids up, finding a way to create confidence, finding a way where our kids see what can be. You know, to me, that's how you build a program. And that's the hardest part. I mean, again, you know, nobody, you know, when you're a football coach, whether you're the head coach or you're an assistant coach, nobody cares how you feel. You know, nobody cares if you're having a bad day. Nobody cares if, oh, this is tough, people don't like me. Nobody cares. But your job as the grown-up or your job as the football coach is to put a smile on your face, go forward, invest in your players, you know, and get better every day. You know, and that's what nobody wants to hear. Everybody wants to hear that you know, you're going to show up magically, reinvent the wheel. No, it's not. It's hard work. You know, it's hard work. You know, put one foot in front of the other and make your guys better every day. You know, and in due time, that's going to happen here.
Were there moments on the flip side? Because actually, I do like hearing that. Maybe I'm unusual, but I find that stuff fascinating because I think that's the stuff we don't get to see a lot of, and the stories that in many ways are more complex and more authentic. Were there moments on the flip side where, despite you know getting beaten pretty bad every week, there's a Wednesday practice where a guy makes a great play or the light bulb goes off for him and you're saying, oh, that's why we recruited that. You know, were there some of those moments too along the way that you know that were like sort of joy that punctuated the drudgery?
I mean, no real specific moments. I mean, you know, 111 is 111. You know, nobody really excited about that. You know, it's not like I'm gonna, you know, high-fiving guys on the side because we did such a great job being 111. But you know, to me, I think when you start 9 freshmen, you know, and there's 3 walk-ons to start at different times in the year. You know, when you're the youngest team in college football, when you're the most undermanned from a scholarship standpoint, you know, it's you and Kansas back there. You know, I mean, I think we traveled 48 scholarship guys one game. You know, basically playing with half a roster. You know, I mean, like, to me, the best things about our football team and about our football program is in the 14 months, okay? And in 14 months, we got 1 win and 11 losses. Okay, in the 14 or now, what is it, May now? In the 15 months, every metric outside of those 1 win and 11 losses is a hockey stick. Okay, had 4 straight record-breaking semesters academically. Okay, we're about to have 100 point increase in the APR from 892 to somewhere near 990-991, depending on how we have a couple guys finish. So academics, hockey stick. From a fundraising standpoint, hockey stick. From a strength conditioning standpoint, the 57 scholarship players with the new guys that we've had that have actually been here for the 14 months, we've gained 690 pounds. So from a strength conditioning standpoint, hockey stick. I mean, we've had dudes go from 250 to 300, from 232 to 280. I mean, just from a strength conditioning standpoint, I've never been around a football team that's as strong, as quick, that has grown physically like we have. From a recruiting standpoint, hockey stick. You know, I mean, probably the best recruiting class in the history of the school. You know, and so to me, like, every metric to measure the football program, you know, and then one of the things that does make you feel good is we're, whatever our record is, 1-10, 1-whatever. You know, and the week we're going to play Northwestern is probably one of the best practice weeks I've ever been around as a football coach. And that's including getting ready to go play, you know, conference championship games. You know, so the kids that are here, they're incredibly positive. They're working their asses off. They're achieving the high levels in all aspects of their life, academically, socially, strength conditioning. I mean, we're doing everything that we need to have to do. We just got to continue to add players. Continue to mature physically. I mean, anytime you start 9 freshmen and 3 walk-ons, there's going to be some challenges.
But the good news is every single freshman, if they redshirted, they started four games. If they didn't, they played the whole year. In two or three years, we're going to be a really old, a really seasoned, a really big, strong, physical, calloused bunch. You know, and we're going to have a really good football program.
Are you concerned about the fact that you didn't have spring ball this year? I mean, obviously no one else in the country did either, but just in terms of building the culture and the continuity piece, where's your head at right now, and how are you kind of making sure that the guys are still locked in on the philosophy that you know? Does it concern you, like, you try to impress so much upon these kids, and now all of a sudden you literally can't be with them at all? I mean, how is this throwing a wrench into your day to day? Besides the, I mean, that's all I got.
Every football coach in the country is concerned with spring ball. You know, when it first happened, I think there was that kind of immediate shock that, some people had already had spring football. Some people had gotten in three or four practices. Most people in the Northeast are, teams that, like to practice later. You know, UMass, even Kentucky likes to practice later. Alabama and Auburn, Notre Dame, Texas haven't had a spring practice yet. The initial shock is, oh, what are we going to do? We don't have spring football. And then very quickly, probably much more importantly after that, we all realize, all right, this is probably a little bit bigger than spring football. And, we've been able to meet our players every day. We meet our players, like I said earlier in the podcast, meet our players every day at 2:30. Our kids have done an incredible job. The NCAA right now won't let us basically oversee, strength conditioning isn't a part of their accountable hours right now. We're only allowed football instruction, so we can't mandatorily make them or supervise them working out. But our kids have been doing an unbelievable job with their body weights. They're doing an unbelievable job at meetings. I mean, they've been doing everything that we've asked them to do in this setting. And certain kids have access to certain weights, all weights, no weights, some weights. So it's different for every kid. But we have done a great job through this process, as good a job as you can do, comparatively to what you could when you were here. And so I'm still really excited about this group of kids that we have and what they've done. And so the biggest thing is everybody in the country is having to deal with it. And so from a competitive advantage standpoint, everybody's got to deal with it. Everybody has to manage it, and somebody's going to do a better job of managing it than others. And we hope that's us.
Will there be a season?
Now, I'm going to preface this with every single football coach that's dumb enough to comment on this gets absolutely murdered and trashed in the media. So take anything I say with a grain of salt.
10-4.
My answer is yes, I believe there will be a football season. I was raised, my dad very simply would always say, if you want to know where the truth is, probably look at where the money is. We all know that high-level college athletics, mainly football, is worth a lot to a lot of places. And to a lot of athletic departments all over this great nation. Okay, and so because of that alone, I can pretty much probably say with great certainty there will be a football season. When, how many weeks, how long the season will be, how equitable will it be, all those details, I have zero clue. The NCAA, we get a lot of guidance from those guys. We're expecting a batch of guidance in May. Here coming up shortly, then another big batch of guidance in late May. And we don't know a ton in terms of details right now. We're all just working as hard as we possibly can, recruiting as hard as we can, doing everything we possibly can with our team to make sure that whenever they say that we can go, we're prepared to go.
If you got a second, and if you got to run, I totally get it. But if you got another second, I do want to touch real.
I'm here for the long haul, brother.
Well, actually,
you're the most famous UMass fan that there is. Listen, I'm here for the long haul.
I gotta ask you though, what prompted you? So I have a theory on why you're doing the podcast now, and I may be paranoid like a college football coach, but
Now, before
you answer this question, you do know that every single one of our practices is open to the media. I will talk to anybody that wants to talk about UMass athletics, okay? Because without people in the media, there is no one pushing the stories of our player.
100%.
I may be the least paranoid person in the history of college football.
Well, and I think
every meeting's open.
I think giving the kid access to your story was really smart. I think it humanized you. It brought you into a new light. I thought just that whole he painted a really nice portrait of the genuine like family atmosphere on your program. So I think that was smart. And I will say I dropped the ball last year. I forget who the SID was, but we were gonna link up, and then I was in the area for a day, and then I had some of my kid, and I couldn't do it. So that was on me. But then I'm half joking here, but I reached out last week on Twitter to your strength and conditioning coach, Shadid, is it? Shadid?
Yeah, Matt Shadid.
And he was like, yeah, I'm down, you know, like, and I was like, I'll hit you up. And then it was on my to-do list. And then before I could hit him up, you slid in the DMs and were like, hey, you still want to do an interview? And I was like, huh, I wonder why he's coming out of the woodwork now, other than being so, just like having time on your hands. So I was intrigued as to the timing, because you also followed me recently, which, you know, obviously it did a nice little number for my ego getting the head coaches on there. But I still need Carville, by the way. So why now? What are you promoting? Are you on a publicity tour a little bit, or are you just bored?
No, absolutely. I tried to do your podcast when I first got hired.
Really?
Let's tell the whole truth now.
No, please do. Please do, because I've given you a hard time for ignoring overtures.
Dude, when I first got here, I had our SID, Cody, reach out, because obviously as the head football coach at the university, like, they typically tell me like what I can and can't do.
Yeah,
from
yeah.
From an interview standpoint, that's kind of how this thing goes. I don't just get to do everything I want to do. But no, I remember we had him when I first got hired here, because it was a very obvious and very apparent from early on that you are an incredible supporter of our program, that UMass athletics is pretty important to you, and that on top of that, you had a lot of folks listening. And as a head football coach trying to build a program, that would make me a jackass if I didn't want to try to reach out to those people and get them excited. So have been trying to do this since I got hired. But obviously when we all have a little bit more time on our hands than usual, I'll just reach out myself. Obviously got the right permission, talked to all of the powers that be.
My buddy tonight, he goes, do you think Bell talked to McCall before? This is a Michigan guy who's like, he's just a good friend of mine, but he loves college sports. And he's like, do you think Bell talked to McCall before he did it? And I was like, if I had to guess, he sent the text to Bamford, and he said, what do you think Bamford said? I was like, I think Bamford said, like, yeah, he loves the program. He's you know, he might try to get you to go places you don't want to go, so suss him out before. But, you know, all in all, it's a net positive, as much as I like to give him a hard time. That was my overarching prediction. Did you actually confer with anybody prior to doing this besides the SID?
SID. You know, and people that had Jay Burnham.
Oh, Burnham's the best.
Yeah, you know, I saw that he did. I was like, hey, what was like that? It was awesome. I was like, okay. So the SID and Burnham.
Burnham's a really good dude, too. He really gets what I think. He's perfect for that job.
I tell you what Burnham does. Burnham has a great sense. He's got a and I don't even know if I'm smart enough to say this correctly. He has a great feel of the room.
100%.
When I say that, I mean just from a, obviously you're in the middle of a 111 season taking ass whippings, and we got to do this radio show on Friday after a practice. We're not feeling great about this deal. He's got a great way of kind of sensing how you feel and putting you at ease, making you come. I mean, he has a great just sensibility about him, and a great he's got a great way of getting you into things that even you may not feel like doing. I mean, but, you know, and again, that's just good dude, great personality, just really informed, and I enjoy, you know, working with him.
Yeah, I mean, UMass has had some really good – when I was a kid in the area growing up, I did a – like a – internship as in high school, where I helped host the radio show with the guy who's now the play-by-play guy at Boise State. And UMass had a long history of good dudes, but Jay is like, I think he's as good as anyone, because what he does really well is he represents the university. He works for the university, and it's clear, but he doesn't make it so ridiculously sugar-coated that it's, you know, inauthentic. And that's a really hard line to find, I think, especially when you're having a hard season. So anyway, Jay's
at the end of the day, tell the truth. You know, I mean, people can be upset with the truth. You know, I mean, I think that's one of the, you know, you talk about coaches being paranoid. It's just anytime you see the media as adversarial, it's probably because they probably spit out some piece of the truth. Now, they may not understand the circumstances that led to that truth. But if somebody says you're bad, how are you going to be upset at them if you're bad? You know, now, again, like I said, they may not do a great job explaining the circumstances or really care about the circumstances. It's not their job to understand the circumstance. But as long as you tell it, like, you know, so many coaches get so worked up when somebody says something bad, it's like, yeah, it's their job. You know, I mean, they got to create clicks. They got to create.
And like, you know, for me on this show, because it's a fan podcast and I have a 9-to-5 and I got two kids, like I'm not here for that, but I am here to be candid and honest as how I see things. But I like the context. And I think podcasts are a good medium for that, because it's not just about clicks. Like, if you're going to listen to this, you're going to listen to Walt Bell in all of his subtlety and nuance. It's not just going
to
be,
you're going to listen to me say, you know, about 17,000 times.
Now you have very few verbal tics, actually, to be like, no joke. I'm trying to think of all our guests. Like, you're pretty, you've done media for sure. I mean, you've definitely, I think being around the SEC, you know, you weren't in the SEC, but were you ever in the SEC? No.
No, Maryland, Florida State, North Carolina. So ACC, Big Ten, Big 12, Conference USA, Sun Belt.
Did you purposely avoid the SEC in any sense, or is it just worked out that way?
It just worked out that way. I mean, you know, it just worked out that way. I mean, I've had a couple chances to go, but whether it was a better opportunity somewhere else or, you know, just not the right time. But no, that wasn't on purpose. You're talking to somebody that's, you know, that grew up a diehard Tennessee fan and, you know, was afraid to go in the living room on Saturday afternoons when Tennessee lost, you know, because my dad was not going to be in a great mood. You know,
was your dad a Tennessee alum?
Grew up with SEC football and grew up in a Tennessee, you know, grew up in a household where football was not necessarily life and death, but it could feel like life and death.
Your dad an SEC, was he a Tennessee alum?
Yes, great granddad, all went to Tennessee.
And so you
Tennessee football fans.
So not, and they were all doctors, right?
Yes.
So not only did you leave the family tradition professionally, you also left it in terms of the academic institution. Have you ever noted that fact? Like, is that something you think about in terms of like being your own man?
I wouldn't go that far. I'd say I was probably the dumb one and the one that was a little more athletically inclined. So there's a trade-off there. You know, so I was good enough to be a four-year letterman at Middle Tennessee State University. You know, I didn't have a pocket protector on when nerding out being a doctor. I'm kidding. Even though my granddad did wear a sweet pocket protector every day. But no, I was the dumb one, you know, and so ended up being a football player, you know, football and baseball guy. Went to Middle Tennessee State University and still went to middle pre-med, you know, ultimately to try to be a doctor. But, you know, some of my dad's issues and unhappiness probably led to, he probably didn't do what he wanted to do. Probably just did what his dad did. Probably my junior year of college, he was just really matter of fact and just wanted me to make sure that I was doing what I wanted to do, you know, and that, if I did what I loved, you know, and did it hard enough that, you know, money and good things would chase you right back. So, you know, ended up going to school pre-med, ended up with, criminal justice pre-law, getting ready to go to, law school at the University of Memphis, and instead, you know, put all my stuff in a Ford Bronco and drove to Lafayette, Louisiana to start GA.
It's a good choice, ultimately. Even regardless of what happened, I still think it's a good choice. That's a topic for another time in terms of what you pursue in life. But give me a little
overview real quickly, because I think last year, because of personnel issues and because of challenges under center and some other things, we didn't really get a true sense, other than the first few series against Rutgers, which were, I mean, you blew the doors off the country for about 15 minutes there. I was at the game. What's your offensive philosophy, and what's your, I mean, schematically, like, how do you approach things? Are you a guy who's in the film room all the time? Are you a guy who sees yourself more as a program builder and is building relationships? Like, how do you kind of divide up your time, and how do you think of football? I guess when I'm saying divide up your time, I'm saying there are certain people in football who you just know have no interest in any of the things outside the lines. You don't strike me as that kind of guy, but, you know, I'm curious, like, where, how you divide your time and how you think about the actual inside the lines game day stuff.
Yeah, you know, I mean, to me, there's two parts to that. I mean, you know, and there's, like, as I alluded to earlier, there's a million ways to do it. There's guys that let their coordinators coordinate, their coaches coach, and they handle the football team and everything outside. I know guys that delegate all that stuff to other people on the staff, and all they do is football. There's a lot of ways to do it. I'm a firm believer in the such thing as there's no such thing as not enough time. You know, and that's probably not the most healthy way to look at things, but, you know, I do football, you know, roughly from, you know, 4:30 in the morning to a certain time in the afternoon. Then I worry about my football team when everybody else is awake, living a normal life. Then we go to practice. Then we do football. And, you know, I mean, you know, just for me, so I'm not worried about, you know, a healthy lifestyle. I'm not necessarily worried about, you know, getting a certain number of hours of sleep every night. You know, I'm worried about getting the job done. So, as I alluded to earlier, if it's not worth overdoing, it ain't worth doing, you know. And so we'll get enough football in, obviously from a program building standpoint, a fundraising standpoint, a team management standpoint. You know, in my role, that comes first now. But we'll get enough football in, you know. And so, you know, from a – and then kind of the other question you alluded to is just from a schematic standpoint. Because obviously last year we were kind of what we had to be. You know, now ultimately what – you know, because I think more importantly, you know, who you're going to be and what we want to be, it's really important. Because, again, I've alluded to, like, you know, we're, like, recruiting the right kids. We got to make sure they're a great fit for UMass, and the reasons they want to be here are, you know, whole part, okay? Well, I think some of the greatest programs in the country, they fit who they are geographically. When you think of Wisconsin, you think of what?
Linemen.
Okay, big, giant people, right? Big, giant Nordic dudes running pout in the lead zone and wide zone at you, right? Okay, and so their style of play fits what they can get. You know, it fits who they are, correct?
Correct.
And they have great success doing that. When you think of Central Florida, you think...
Central Florida, I think athletes who couldn't, who for whatever reason, didn't stick at UF or FSU.
Okay, so a bunch of fast dudes, okay, doing something a little bit outside the ordinary from a split and spread standpoint, but playing fast, and so that fits them, correct?
Correct.
Okay. Well, what we're ultimately building is what is a great geographical fit for not only who we are, but what we can get from a skill standpoint, what we can get from a alignment standpoint, the type of weather that when we play big football games in the future, the type of weather that we're going to be playing in, you know, to me is, you know, what we were last year is kind of what we had to be. You know, when we got here, we had six scholarship O linemen. It's going to be really hard to get big and you know, we had two scholarship tight ends on the roster. You know, it's going to be hard to get in a bunch of big personnel and go main people and run the football and be blue collar. We didn't have a fullback. You know, really thin a running back. You know, we have Bilal Ali, some young guys. You know, we had to move Cam Roberson from slot receiver to running back. You know, and so it's kind of, you know, you got to go with what you got for me there. But no, ultimately, we want to be a big physical, hit you in the face football team. You know, that's ultimately what we want to be. Why? Because we're in the land of giant people.
you know, I can probably get, and we as a staff can probably get better offensive linemen, interior defensive linemen than I could at Southern Miss or Arkansas State, simply because in the South there's so few of those people that they get over recruited. Like, we can get great linemen here. We can get great tight ends here. We can get big backs here, you know, and to me it's, and you saw that in last recruiting class. I mean, five big, long offensive linemen, you know, and a developmental tackle, and then six defensive linemen, big people, big parts, you know, and to me it's a big, strong, physical, run the ball at you football team, you know, and last year we couldn't really do that, but that's what we'll turn into. That's how we're going to continue to grow the program, you know, hopefully a program that kind of represents its people is a great geographic fit.
That's really interesting. So you don't really envision this as like a spread them out, throw the ball 40 times a game kind of, because I feel like when you first came, I thought of you when you were an offensive coordinator as a bit more of a pass friendly approach. Am I making that up?
Yeah, I mean, to me, you got to go with what you got.
Right.
There's only so many people in this business that are lucky enough to get great enough jobs. They can do whatever they want to do. It doesn't matter because they're always going to have great players. There's very few people in this business that are lucky enough to do that. You know, and even if, you know, hell, our first year at Maryland, you know, had to play four different quarterbacks. Our first year at Maryland, I had to play four quarterbacks. Still finished third in the Big Ten in rushing. My second year at Maryland, I had to play five quarterbacks. Still finished, you know, fourth in the league in rushing. You know, in 14 and 15, Arkansas State, we were top 10 in the country in scoring both years. You know, broke all the Sun Belt Conference records in 2015, but we were still second in the league in rushing. I mean, I've always been a run-first guy. Now, just whatever allows you to run the football the best. Here, that's going to be big, physical, at you. You know, and on top of that, at UMass, we're going to have to do things a little bit different. You know, and to me, if the whole world is doing what, you know, Coach Dorr and Coach Kelly and Rich Rodriguez did, you know, in 2000, you know, and kind of what I cut my teeth on as an offensive coordinator and as a position coach, you know, spread one back, no huddle, playing real fast, is now the whole world 10 years later is doing that. We've got a chance to go make ourselves different, you know, and be bigger and be rougher and be tougher. And as defenses get smaller, we've got a chance to go get better and create an advantage for ourselves. You know, again, as I alluded to, be the Stanford of the G5.
You see, I think that's a really good point, because I think so much of college football, it's fad happy. You know, there's a fad for a few years and then everybody does it and it evolves, and you got guys, you know, Gus Malzahn's out of the high school ranks, and all of a sudden, and before you know it, you know, that's not the fad anymore. And so I guess I think the regional approach sounds, I guess what I'm saying is I buy that is working with the personnel you have. So you're not wedded to one ideology or style, it sounds like.
You know, 2, 3, 4 years from now, we want to be the bullies. We want to be the bad guys. You know, we want to make it a rough, physical, blue collar, nasty game. You know, and that's ultimately what we want to be. You know, and that's what we've been building to from a strength and conditioning standpoint. You know, it's why the way we lifted off season, in season. You know, all, you know, last year when you're playing damn near all freshmen and sophomores, but if you're not playing over 30, 40 plays a game, you're lifting 4 or 5 times a week, you know, in small bursts, trying to get bigger, build volume, mandatory. I mean, we're trying to become the biggest physical football team that we possibly can, you know, and to me, that's going to be a great fit for who we are. It's going to make us different. It's going to allow us to win games that we should.
Do you think there's any schemes from that you believe need to be altered at all or tweaked from last year, or should last year be taken as kind of a look, we did what we had to do given the roster constraints, and you shouldn't really, as fans, conceive of that as reflective of what's coming in the future?
I mean, two things. Number one, you know, again, you do what you got to do, you know, when you inherit a job. You know, you go do what you know, with what you have allotted. You go attack it and you go do everything you possibly can to give those young people a chance to be the best they can be. But
from a recruiting standpoint, from a program development standpoint, that's not what we want to be. X and O wise, it's not what we want to be. You know, from a that's not who we're going. I mean, not who we want to be. Screw that. That's not who we're going to be. You know, and so yeah, there will be things that be different, but because of player development, recruiting, playing all those young people a year ago, so now there's seven, eight offensive linemen that you're really excited to play. Taking extra tight ends, now there's going to be, four or five 250, 55 pound kids as opposed to two. Taking bigger back, Ellis Merriweather, 230 pound tailback. We're growing this thing in the right way. It's just, the hardest thing to do in football, is develop big kids. And so that's why we took six defensive linemen and five offensive linemen and two tight ends in this last class, because we got to get those guys developing now.
What's been the biggest surprise about the UMass, how UMass sells and, or is perceived in the football world when you're out on the road? And not so much like your biggest surprise since getting to UMass, but from the roster standpoint, but just from the being in Amherst, being in Massachusetts, like what did you not expect? I know McCall often has issues with the weather, just little lifestyle tweaks for your wife or, your daughter. What's it been like just coming up to Amherst?
The good news is Dixon, Tennessee is exactly like Amherst, Massachusetts. Very similar in size. Very similar in good people, a much better food culture. That is one thing that has been awesome about UMass, is somebody that likes to eat and likes to cook. I mean, just between Amherst, Hadley, Northampton, great restaurants, great places to eat, in comparison to most small towns in the South. Great food culture, good people, easy to get around. Being a woefully addicted workaholic, the fact that I can get to work with really no commute in 8 to 10 minutes is huge. That does allow me to spend whatever time left over in an expedited fashion with my wife. It's a perfect place to build a program, and especially, somebody that doesn't crave a lot of attention, somebody that enjoys being able to travel pretty freely. It's a great place for me.
Yeah, I was going to say, two things on that. One thing I was going to say is I've always believed, my philosophy about how UMass football can become what I think it can become is actually selling Western Mass. I think a lot of people in the area sometimes think, well, Boston's the center of power in the state and Western Mass is a little bit sleepy. I actually think if you look at what Penn State did in terms of its relationship to the metropolitan areas of that state, it became a Saturday destination. I'm not saying UMass can be Penn State, but I'm just pointing out that Penn State was not always Penn State. And it wasn't that long ago where they still, I guess it was kind of now, maybe I'm aging myself, but I mean, it's been, in the
60s. I was born in 1984 and Penn State has been pretty damn good the whole time.
No, they have. But I was born in 85, but if you look back, they weren't great. I mean, in 90, they weren't even in the Big Ten, I think, until 92.
Yeah, they were independent. And then the Big East said no because they thought that Penn State football would, ruin the basketball. So they had to go to the Big Ten.
Hoops was in the Atlantic Ten when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And
really?
Yeah.
I did not know that.
Yeah. I mean, and Rutgers was in the Atlantic Ten and West Virginia was in the Atlantic Ten. And Virginia Tech was in the Atlantic Ten.
That's a hell of a basketball.
Yeah, it was an incredible league. I mean, Rutgers and Penn State, they left kind of early, maybe 99, or no, Rutgers was there till 94, but Penn State left probably a little before I got into it, probably 90, 91. But my point is, I think Western Mass, it's got the best foliage in the world, right, in the fall. It's a unique college destination. And for people coming, from the Boston area where most of your alumni are, I actually, in New York and elsewhere, I actually think the destination day vibe of Amherst is a really unique thing that can be a selling point in terms of the eventual culture you want to build around. And I think people don't always realize that because it's a really desirable place to go in the fall. So I think sometimes people get really caught up in
you know, making sure, making inroads in the Boston area. It's about getting the Boston area people out to Western Mass and making football a core function of why they do. So that's my, that's my.
Yeah, from a recruiting standpoint, I mean, the majority, you know, and obviously, I mean, you know, anytime you speak in absolutes, you know, it's pretty absolute that you don't know what you're talking about. But the majority of kids, when you really recruit from D.C. to New York City, I mean, when the East Coast is really 85% of your recruiting class every year, that's majority of kids from big cities. And typically, when we have official visits and we get kids to campus in official visit settings where we can spend 48 hours with families, they love it. You know, I mean, to them, it's almost like going on vacation, you know, to get out of the city, you know, to go somewhere. Fresh air, great college environment, not worry about their kids' safety. You know, to feel like their kid's in a safe place, getting a great education. You know, I mean, to the majority of the parents, that they love that fact about us. You know, they don't worry about their kid as much.
Yeah, that's the sell. I mean, I think the Boston, like, people don't get that, like, Amherst is not Boston, and that's okay. That's a selling point in certain instances. Boston's great, don't get me wrong. It has asset, you know, things you want to leverage, but also Boston already has the Patriots, right? Like, I mean, New England is a unique region, and I think you got to tap into the quirks of exactly where you are. That's my, I'm dispensing advice here that was unsolicited, but that's kind of, I don't even know where we were before that, but that's my.
What other questions do you have?
No, you know what? Like, I guess, here's what the last thing I want to ask you. Because people, I asked a couple of people what I, you know, schematically, and I'm not as interested in that. But I am interested, and you alluded to it a little bit. You've been at places like Florida State where the palace intrigue is just unreal. I mean, you Google your name, and I mean, you must know this, and all sorts of things come up that, you know, about fallout with the head coach there, and, you know, all these things that I think are fairly, you know, like, I don't like working for one boss, I go work for another, whatever it is, that are kind of benign, that become huge, huge stories and message board threads and the whole nine. What is it like being at, it was part of the appeal at UMass, the fact that, you know, while they took their football seriously, you could live your life while building a program? Was that part of the appeal? And what's it like being in an environment where the palace intrigue isn't quite as strong every second?
You want me to be completely honest? The answer is yes.
Only.
yeah, I mean, completely honestly, I've never really given a shit what anybody thought about how we did our jobs, you know. If we, as a staff, you know, because obviously my first time being a coach, so my entire life as an assistant has been dedicated to doing the best job that I humanly possibly can for my boss. Doesn't always mean I agree with how we do that job. Doesn't, you know, mean that I'm going to do it that way if I was a head coach. Doesn't necessarily mean that I believe in it. But my job is to do exactly what he wants me to do as hard as I can possibly do it, whether I agree with it or not. Because, you know, the first key to being, you know, a great leader is to be selfless enough to be a great servant and soldier, you know. And so, coming from a military family, I've never thought of what people thought of how I did my job, because my job was always to do the best job I possibly could for the football team, you know. And so, as long as I'm doing that, as long as I'm exhausting every, you know, every bit of brain power, every bit of physical time, as long as I feel like that I'm doing everything humanly possible within my capabilities, physically, mentally, socially, whatever it may be, to help my kids' lives, my players' lives be better, and execute the goal of the head football coach, I really never cared, you know. And so I don't think that's really ever changed, you know. I mean, I can tell you this, like, if you're going to be in athletics, you know, hell, when I was a senior in high school, you know, when I was a senior in high school, we lost a playoff football game, came home, the windows were knocked out of my car. Football's pretty damn important in Dixon, Tennessee.
Who knocked the windows out?
I have no idea.
I mean, did you drop a ball in the end zone?
No, I was a quarterback, played like shit, lost the game. But, you know, I mean, hell, I probably honestly probably deserve to get my windows knocked out. But, you know, I mean, like, if you play high-level athletics, you know, I mean, you're going to deal with some aspect of people not liking how you do your job. And that's a fact. It's a part of it, you know. You know, some people allow it to affect them differently. I just never have. You know, I'm typically very, very wrapped up. Again, am I doing what's best by my players? Am I doing what's best by my staff? Am I doing what's best for the program? You know, and if I do those things and we get the job done, awesome. All the people that said all that negative stuff, they'll have to deal with it. Okay. You know, they'll probably be the people that said they were there all along. You know, if we don't and we lose and, you know, we get our asses fired, you know what? I'm going to be out of a job and not be able to pay rent. You know, I mean, it is what it is.
But the reality is, on some level, distractions can matter if they begin to affect performance of the football team, right? I mean, like, surely when the rumor mill is swirling about players at Florida State and there's few, you know, boo birds in the stands, like, that impacts how certain guys react to what they do, right? I mean, like...
Absolutely. But I'm not going to be one of them.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? You know what I'm saying? Like, that's... As a high-level competitor, like, you've got to do a great job preparing your football team for that. You know what? Because the negative, be really honest with you, the negative is a hell of a lot easier to deal with than the positive.
How so?
Wait till we start winning bowl games here.
Yeah.
Then it'll be the other thing. Then it'll be every single time we win a game, or every single time we win a bowl game, or every single time we have a successful season, it'll be, oh, hey, coach's leaving.
Yeah.
He don't really love it here. He don't want to be here. Why would you come here? He's just going to go run off. You know, it'll be, you know, I mean, you know, you had a great season. You know, I mean, maybe you should transfer to another place. I mean, just.
Yep.
I mean, there's whether you're winning or whether you're losing, there's always stuff to deal with, you know, and your ability to focus all that energy on the task at hand, not only as an athlete, as a coach, as a leader of a team, you know, your ability to get all that energy in one place, in one direction, and, you know, get all those differing personalities and people with different personal goals and different selfish ambitions, I mean, to get those people to buy into the fact that, you know, egoless, selfless, us winning at a high level will, you know, propel each of us individually to what it is that we want. I mean, that's the skill. You know, that's the skill. You know, and so, like, there's going to be adversity in every place you go. There's going to be people that say all kinds of stuff. I really care. What do my players think? What does my wife think? What does my small, limited family think? And other than that, I really... Yeah, don't really care very much.
Do you have to push back on? I mean, that's recruiting, right? It's a nasty world. Like, I've read enough over the years about. I spent some time in Oxford, Mississippi in my time, so I know about recruiting a little bit. I mean, you got to deal with that in recruiting, right? I mean, like when there's a misperception of you with the recruit, do you just address it the way you basically did with me just now?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's all you can do. You know, authenticity is truth telling. You know, I mean, to me, in recruiting, you know, in whatever it may be, you know, tell the truth. You've seen 8 Mile, right? You've seen 8 Mile?
No. Who?
Okay. 8 Mile.
Oh, 8 Mile. You mean like the Eminem movie?
Yeah, absolutely. Eminem, right?
Yeah.
And you got to go beat the guy to the punch. You got to say all the things. You got to beat him to it. You got to say all the things about him. You know, I mean, just tell the truth. Now tell them, hey, look, every single coach in the history of college football, we're all biased. We're all trying to tell you what you think you want to hear. We're all trying to say, okay, what we think that you want to hear. Okay, every single one of these meetings you sit in with another head coach, they're all going to tell you whatever they think it is that you want to hear. So instead of you doing that, why don't you tell me what you think is important? And why don't you make me prove how I'm going to get that done for you? You know, that's a lot easier way to recruit. And it's a lot more forthright, and people are probably a little bit more apt to listen, you know, and create some trust, you know, and some relationship that actually can last when you're forthright and upfront and you aren't, you know, sitting there playing the game wearing a mask.
You still love recruiting?
I love the end result of recruiting. and when I say end result, I don't mean a name on a dotted line. I mean,
4 years later, you got the baton after their parents ran 300 meters of 18 years of their life, and it's 4 years later, and how much they've changed physically, mentally, from a maturity standpoint, the end result, the grown up that comes out of the process, that's the cool part.
So for you, recruiting is ultimately a vehicle to player development. That's where you
absolutely. You know, and again, you know, I mean, obviously recruiting is the lifeblood of everything that we do. There ain't a great coach in the world that doesn't have good players. There isn't one. Okay. For every great coach in the planet, I can show when he had to actually coach a team of average to below average players, they took ass whippings too. Okay, like, recruiting is the lifeblood of everything that we do. You know? So it's obviously the most important thing that we do. But there are certain ways to do it where it's not only rewarding for you as a coach, it's rewarding to the players, rewarding to your program, and you know, you can actually fulfill your goals as a human being, you know, in the process.
So that's a great way to end it, unless there's anything you want to, we tell folks, you can come on and promote whatever you want to promote. You can give us your Twitter handle. You can tell us, you know, a sales pitch for the season ahead. If there's anything you want to let people know that you think is important for the program or you in general, just now's the moment.
Now is the moment. I'll leave you with this. Here in the very near and foreseeable future, we're going to go to the first bowl game in the history of the program. Okay? And the year after that, we're going to go to the second. Great things are going to happen here. Okay? We're going to build a program that everyone can be proud of. We're going to do it the right way. Our kids are going to graduate. They're going to work their asses off. They're going to be gracious. They're going to play the game the right way. They're going to play the game in a way that makes the people around here proud. And we're going to build something really special here. Okay? And I just, again, I at least want you to hear it from my voice with great resolve and great conviction, because I have more resolve for everything that we've done here in 15 months, regardless of the one win and the 11 losses, than I did the day I took the job. Okay? In the very, very near and foreseeable future, we're going to go to two bowl games, the first two bowl games in the history of this institution. Okay? And there'll be a lot of people that didn't think that we could do it, and it's going to get done. It's going to be a hell of a lot of fun when we get there.
You have my commitment. I will be at the bowl game.
Amen.
So, mark my words, I'll be at the bowl game. Thanks for doing the show. Really appreciate it. Seriously, it means a lot to us, and I know UMass fans are going to be eternally grateful to get this much time from you. So thanks a lot, Walt. We really appreciate it.
Absolutely, bud. And again, if you ever want me to come back on, if I didn't say you know too many times or upset anybody too bad, anytime you speak for an hour and 30 minutes, I'm sure there's somebody I upset or somebody I didn't mention or, you know, probably said something I shouldn't have said, but, you know.
See, I would have, if I was you right there, I would have just like plugged that one recruit you really, you know, just like subtly got him in there and been like, hey, you know how much you matter to me? I mentioned you on the podcast that all the UMass fans
listen. If I would have done that, that would have been an NCAA violation. I would have never gotten
him. Oh, see, that's why you're a head coach and I'm a shit talker. All right, man.
I appreciate it, brother.
Thanks a lot. From my past, have ridiculous ass. She attended UMass and she passed every class. Walked down the hall with a stuck up sass. Talked to basketball players. She like how they pass. But when I used to hit it, the ball catch, she quit it. She wouldn't admit it. But shorty was a dick. Okay. Mailbag time. And I am eating popcorn. For those of you who can't resist making a reference to my snack habits on the air. I resisted for the entirety of the Bell episode. I have since returned, 30 or 40 minutes, 50 minutes later maybe, and I'm eating. So if you don't like that, I don't know what to tell you. Here's what we got tonight. Of course, the mailbag, like all segments of this wonderful program, is brought to you by the fine folks at Five College Movers, world-class stress-free moving in the Pioneer Valley and beyond. If you're going anywhere, go with Five College. All right. Son of Large Mark says, hope I didn't miss the cut, but what is your ideal A-10? And you can't keep Fordham just because they are geographically convenient for you to attend games at. I can't. I mean, you asked me for my ideal A-10. So if you want my non-ideal A-10, but like, all right, fine. Under that scenario, I'm still going to give you an answer. It's going to be insufficient for you because I'm going to give you a New York team. So if you drop Fordham, you've got to replace them with Manhattan College, program that's probably inferior to Fordham in many ways. No, in seriousness, I don't know. I really think you do need a New York team in the A-10. And there's just not a ton of options. And there's a case to be made for Stony Brook, which is a good program, kind of on the rise, good school. But that's pretty far out in Long Island. It's like 45, 50 minutes onto Long Island. It's a ways. So I really don't count that as a New York region. It's like counting Holy Cross as like a Boston team. It's just not. Likewise with Hofstra, they're a little closer on Long Island, but it's just not a city team. Brooklyn is in the five boroughs. Like that means something. It's in the Bronx. There's a dense population center there. I don't know. So I really don't want to let Fordham go. But if you're going to make me, maybe Patino gets Iona where they need to be. I think Iona's in New Rochelle, which is just outside the city and pretty easy to get to. So I'll count that. I'll say Iona if they get good under Patino. And apparently have some big spenders there who want to get involved. So replace those two. I've said this a little bit before, but I'd get rid of LaSalle right away. First of all, I do away with the 14-team thing. Doesn't matter. Don't need 14 teams. Could easily do with 12. So get rid of LaSalle and get rid of Fordham. Place Fordham with Iona. And then the tricky thing with this question is, in years past, like 3 or 4 years ago, it would have been very easy to just say Duquesne. But Duquesne's legit now. Not only do they hire a fantastic head coach, LeBron's former high school coach, but who will be there for, who appears set to retire there and has a good 5 or 6 more years in him, you got to think, whose father played there and has a connection to the program, and who they're paying, as far as I know. Like, they're paying pretty well. Not only that, but they just built they're building a new arena and maybe a new practice facility, too. I mean, they're spending, so whatever it is, like, they're all of a sudden in the mix. And, Pittsburgh's a legit market. So normally I would say Duquesne, but they finally invested. So beyond that, I think I'd have to say Bonnie. And I know people hate this. They absolutely hate this. But I just think that, and especially now, after quarantine stuff and after COVID, small private colleges that don't have massive endowments are going to take a hit. Bonnie was like on the verge of collapse 15, 20 years ago. Major basketball scandal, you can look it up, that, in many ways almost threatened to derail the entire institution. They're always running, like, deficits and whatnot. And it costs a lot of money to be in the Atlantic 10. And eventually, Mark Schmidt is going to, if he wants, he's either going to retire or he's going to go to somewhere legit. Boy, I'm eating kernels tonight. I'm fucking with people at this point. Sorry, that's not cool. Take yourself seriously. Have some self-respect, Sage. Come on. Chomps down another. I think Bonnie, when Schmidt leaves, I know they have great tradition, they have good history, whatever. I just don't see someone else being able to do it there. I just don't see it as being sustainable in this day and age. I really don't. And by the way, I think they can be great. I think for them, it would make sense to join the, MAAC and just dominate up there. They've got other local schools. They've got Canisius and Niagara in the area, more or less. Just dominate that region. That's where all the alums are anyway. You know, fucking crush Marist and Fairfield and be right in the mix with, you know, Siena every year. Siena's another team you can make an argument for going to the A-10. Shockingly large fan base in a town with nothing else going on that's not that small. It's the capital of New York and Albany. So there's a case we made for Siena joining the A-10 at some point. But for now, it's probably Bana and LaSalle out, Iona in. But it's kind of a cop-out because of the factors I was given. I still want to keep Fordham, and I still believe someday, against my better judgment, some rich alum there, and there are plenty, will just be like, fuck this, I want to win. And they'll find somebody, and they'll do it. And I think it'll be good for the league. It's also just a great place to watch a game. Gregory Legger, or is it Ledger? I always forget. The Living Legger is the handle. You mentioned that your wife is a sports fan. I don't recall mentioning that, but she is. I guess I've probably mentioned it many times. Does she have a college team she's a fan of? Or have you got her to become a UMass fan? I've gotten her more or less casually interested in UMass. She was a Division III athlete. Very, very smart woman. Elite academic school. High school valedictorian. Real winner. Someone recently remarked on a picture of us on her birthday that I posted. I can't believe she'd stay with you given your UMass fandom. Like, thanks for the comment on Instagram. If you're listening, you know who you are. Class move. But the problem with her, and all marriages have problems, is that she's a very serious Yankees fan. Very serious. Where I sit recording right now, behind me to the side is a Mariano Rivera framed poster. And behind me is a Yankee Stadium, like, basically the subway stop sign is behind me. And I've been vowing to take down at least one of them for a while, but she would lose her shit. And sometimes marriage is just about harm reduction. And so I haven't done it. Shame on me. You could say I'm emasculated. Say whatever you want, but sometimes when you got two kids and an otherwise pretty good marriage, you pick your battles. She also has a signed Derek Jeter boarding pass because her mother used to work for one of the major airlines. Now, maybe I shouldn't have revealed that fact. Mom worked in the airport. I'll just say that. I don't want to get in trouble. She doesn't work there anymore, so I guess it doesn't really matter. But you don't reveal too much. People have like asked me, like, oh, can you get me, you know, passes to the lounge at such and such airport? And I'm like, I don't know. Maybe. So, yeah. And we are both Knicks fans, fortunately. Because my parents, who moved to Western Mass in their 20s, early to mid-20s, I guess, now are almost 70. They're both from New York. And so when I was a kid, the Knicks were good when UMass was good. So I had, like, epic coming-of-age fandom-wise. Never, like, I don't watch Knicks games anymore. They've just been so trash for so long. I watch, like, the very first part of the season sometimes. And then I watch the playoffs, but they're never in it. That's my NBA fandom anyway. Playoffs in general. With the Knicks, I'll watch, like, the first few games sometimes. And they suck by, like, week two. So you're like, fuck, I don't care. But, so we're both Knicks fans. Like, she'll root for UMass, just for me. But she doesn't, like, care. You know what I mean? She's, like, happy to see them succeed because, you know. But, and she's always like, oh, well, the kids will be UMass fans, and so they'll be Yankee fans. And I'm a Red Sox fan. Now, I used to be as big a Red Sox fan as I am a UMass fan from, let's say, 98. Kind of like right when UMass fell off a little bit and the Red Sox started getting good. Like, I went to playoff games in 99. So I'd say like 98 to 05, I was a huge fan, which felt like a long time because it was basically sixth grade through high school, which is a long period when you're living it. Now it's nothing. It's nothing. When you, once you're in your 30s, it's like you blink and that period's done. But that was a formative time. But once they won the first World Series, you know, I moved away and, you know, it just didn't mean as much anymore. Like, it, I mean, and I think any Red Sox fan who's my age and says otherwise is kind of lying. Like, I think now it's been rekindled to some degree with 13 and then 18. But if you remember, like, when they won in 07, 3 years later, it just didn't feel like anything to me. I know a lot of you would be like, oh, but I'm telling you, I was a diehard Red Sox fan. Like, went to 10, 12 games a year. I haven't been to Fenway since 07 because I moved to New York in 08. And it's just real hard to get to Boston during baseball season. I go out to the Cape in the summer for a week. But like, I just can't get there. I really want to go back to Fenway, but I used to go all the time. Anyway, whenever the Sox play the Yankees and whenever playoff season, playoff baseball comes, I'm a diehard Red Sox fan again. But the Yankees are, you know, 15 minutes from my apartment. And, like, it's easy to take the kids. And I tell my kids I hate the Yankees. I mean, one of my kids is just turned 5 months old yesterday, so, like, I don't think he gets that. But my other kid just gets a kick out of seeing me and my wife, like, bicker over it. Still, he turns 4 in 2 weeks. He's not, like, really there yet when it comes to the subtleties of fandom. But long story short, she might win that battle, and it's going to suck. So I'm sort of already preparing for it. Maybe I'll get my second kid into the Sox. I don't know. Whatever. So, yeah. He'll be a UMass fan for sure. And my kid, like, knows a lot about UMass now. Like, he my 4-year-old is, like, or my almost 4-year-old, he'll reference stuff, like, all the time. Like, he saw my dad wearing, like, a Massachusetts, team gear. UMass team gear the other day on FaceTime. He was like, UMASS. Like, just like, I see you. It's kind of cool. Riff Raff Street Pat, PVL7, my man. You can greenlight a scripted Netflix limited series on any post-Cal hoop season. It's a great question. Always the best questions from Pat. Do you go Bruiser following a legend, Ford's last season, the Chaz Turney year, a macabre lapis slog? Is it macabre or macabre? I think it's macabre. You don't pronounce the R, right? It's a word I write down. I never, like, say it. Last year's locker room drama. McCall's first year with the Kelsey presser as a cold open. Such a funny question because the idea that anyone would, outside of, like, the listeners of the show, would ever want to watch this, you know, season on the brink with a mediocre UMass team is just such a funny idea to ponder. So for 30 for 30 or Netflix, not 30 for 30, but, you know, highbrow documentarian work, you know, it's gotta go beyond sports. It's gotta have, like, say something bigger about the culture or something. Now, I'm going to assume, for the sake of this hypothetical, that there exists a cash. Is it cachet or cash? I think it's cash. Yeah, it's cash. Of footage. Just massive, massive amounts of footage that no one's ever seen, a la the Jordan documentary on ESPN. So that's going to change the dynamics here. And I think, I'll tell you what I'm going to pick. I'm going to pick Derek Gordon's season after he came out. And I think there's a way of doing that in a really interesting, subtle way. And it's got to be a few years from now when it's sufficiently in the rearview mirror. Because the challenge and the interesting thing about that, from a storytelling perspective, that I think defies
conventional narrative. And let me be very careful with what I say here, because I don't want to in any way be construed as saying anything remotely homophobic, discriminatory. I have a gay sister. I got plenty of gay friends. I know that's trite to say, like, but one of the great fans of this show and one of the great UMass Twitter members is a trans woman. One of the, there are so many gay fans of this show. So let me just, I am team gay. I want to be very clear about that. Well, pause, I'm not actually gay, but you get what I'm saying. Derek Gordon, for a variety of complex reasons that I don't entirely blame on him, was, in retrospect, maybe not the best first gay guy to do it when it came to being Division I athlete at a high level. And that is not a knock on what he was going through. Was immensely difficult. No one will ever deny that. It's a very challenging predicament what he had to enter into. For any kid in their early 20s to be the first is incredibly challenging. However, Derek Gordon thought he was a lot better than he was. And that had nothing to do with him being gay. It just had to do with him thinking he was better than he was. And as a result, you know, I think that people maybe didn't ever look past the feel-good side of that story, which genuinely was feel-good, and it was good that UMass was, you know, was sort of in a historic spot to recognize this and did the, do the right things. But Derek still thought he was like an NBA player, and then eventually transferred to Seton Hall, which would be the sort of end of that movie. And if I'm not mistaken, that was the season after Chaz left. And the team was still expected to be pretty good. At one point, it was 16-9 down the stretch. And I just wonder how the Derek Gordon stuff, if at all, impacted the locker room. Not from a, oh, we have a gay player aspect, but from a, I'm now sort of a celebrated, rightly so, celebrated national figure for a moment in time. But I also am like playing like I think I'm going to go to the NBA. And the challenges that the players must have faced, not wanting to appear like they had anything against him for coming out, but also like maybe being frustrated with style of play. Now, granted, he also was one of the toughest players to ever play at UMass and a team player first, but, you know, his shot selection left something to be desired. And, you know, I just think just like having the first gay player is interesting also. So there is all that. Like, that's just flat out interesting as a narrative. You know, because surely there's some guys on the team who, you know, were probably homophobic to some degree or had internalized prejudice of some sort. Combine that with the fact that DG maybe was a little bit delusional about his actual talents, and you have a swirling current of lots of different themes that a good director could kind of make something interesting of. Tyler O'Day says, what's the first must-win game this basketball season? Well, presumably they'll play somebody not great to start, and they'll have to win the first game. Like, because there's going to be some other tough ones, and the expectations are going to be really high, and so you can't open with a loss. Can't. Just can't happen. Cannot happen. Unless it's like, somehow you get Duke on the schedule or something. Stu Ludicky, S. Ludicky 93. I still got to get Stu on the show as a guest. Stu, I know you DM me about this, and I want to get you back on, but just, I don't know, hit me up one of these days. We'll figure it out. Shout out to Whitney, Stu's wife, who made the logo for the show and who Five College Movers
has vowed to give courtside tickets to still when they get up here from Denver. Says, what's your starting lineup of players in the last 3 years? Now, this is a good one because we always do the starting lineup for, you know, the current team. He says he will go Pip, Carl, TJ, Jonathan, Laurent, and Trey. All right, last 3 years. Now, I presume that means basically like it doesn't count next year, right? So that's the case. I'm going to say, yeah, Pip's in there. Trey's in there. Those are locks. Carl basically is in there because he started pretty much every game. I'm putting DeBaji Walker over Jonathan Laurent. Some people won't like that. I think he is a better team guy. I think Jonathan Laurent had some real impressive games. Don't get me wrong. A lot of talent. But he also had some nights where he took a lot of possessions off. And I don't know how great he was in the locker room. I like DeBaji. Just like everyone knows, like I'm probably irrationally high on DeBaji. I'm just a big DeBaji guy. Yeah, and TJ. I'm trying to think. Actually, no. Let me be real here. Probably take out DeBaji, put in TJ, and then okay, well, so here's the tricky thing. I was going to say Rashawn Holloway. I think Rashawn Holloway gets a bit of an unfair rap. I think Rashawn Holloway was like a real skilled big man, and you start him, and then like maybe he plays 6 minutes, and maybe he plays 28. But like when you get a good Rashawn Holloway, he's legit. Rashawn Holloway was like really legit at times. So everybody's gonna, you can play him at the, I mean, people are just like, you have to play him and Trey both at the five. Like, but you can just play big and have two old school bigs down low and bang for a while. And Pip and Pierre and Weeks, you get two great shooters, two huge dominant bigs of different varieties, and a legit scoring point guard who maybe isn't the greatest pure point guard. But, like, that's a very old-school, compelling lineup in a lot of ways. I feel like that's got – I mean, you got five guys who can score the basketball. And then you can bring everybody else off the bench. Like,
I don't care what anyone says. That's the lineup. I'm sticking to it. Eli Sloven, he says, what do you think the odds are that we retain dudes on the hoops team if UMass didn't have a season, but other schools did? Same for football. Well, I mean, he says this obviously assuming the one-time transfer thing doesn't go through. Well, I mean, you're saying if it's announced that there's no basketball and no football at UMass, but everywhere else there is, well, then everybody's leaving. Why are they going to sit out for, like, why are they just going to? I mean, maybe some guys like love UMass so much, but they want to play basketball or football. So I think that's obvious, right? No? Maybe I'm misreading this. We couldn't really retain a lot of guys if everyone else had a season. Oh, you're saying if the one-time transfer rule doesn't go through. So, like, randomly UMass doesn't play. Everybody else does. And if they want to, and the only, okay, that's a real weird hypothetical. And they'd have to, so they could go somewhere else and sit out for a year, or they could just, so basically they have to sit out a year. Would they stick around UMass? No, they'd go somewhere where, I don't know. I think they'd leave. I just think it'd be like, well, why can't my school play? And not really think through the rest. And they wouldn't be wrong. Let's see. Anything else? That looks to be it. There was definitely some last week that I never took for the Freddy episode, which I still don't know how we're going to release, as I've mentioned in the intro and on Twitter. I'm going to just look up last week's mailbag. I'm doing a search right now. Curry Hicks mailbag. Curry Hicks Sage. By the way, the juxtaposition between the quality of the Bell interview and the shittiness of this mailbag is hard to overstate. Let's see. The last time I said mailbag, 6 days ago, and here's what I got. Son of Large Mark again says, you can take one guy from the 13-14 team and put them on the 2021 team. Who you got? Ooh, great question. So the obvious answer, everybody's going to be like, well, you have to pick Chaz. You have to pick Chaz. Is Chaz the same player he was in 13-14 on a team not built like that? It's a really interesting question. And I also want to see Javon Garcia develop. And I want Trey Mitchell to get the ball. And I don't know what you want in the press. I mean, you know what? There's a temptation to say someone else. Gaber 205 answered and said Putt or Maxi. And I do think I think you have Putts kind of already. You have DeAndre Dominguez and you have Debaji Walker, who are pretty similar. Maxi you don't have, because you don't really have a second. You don't really have a freak athletic big on the roster. Dominguez may become that, but to have an experience like Maxi as a junior, I guess he would have been. Yeah, that would be a really nice piece. So it's definitely Maxi or Chaz. Assuming Noah Fernandez is eligible, and you have him and Javon Garcia and Colton Mitchell, and you're good at point, I'm taking Maxi because it's a real piece you need, and it's a piece I think that would be fucking great in the press. And like, I think I always thought Maxi was sometimes not fully, you know, taken advantage of. I don't think his skills were maximized at times, and I think he'd be really good on like a Bergeron defense. So I'd say Maxi in the end. Gaber 205 says, if Pat Kelsey goes to Wake, and by the way, he didn't, so this question is all for naught, but I thought about it. How are we getting to Jamaica? Because UMass is playing Jamaica, apparently, and are playing Wake Forest in Jamaica this year. How many of us are going? What are our signs going to say? How many people will get tossed, etc.? Now, I thought about this a lot, because here's the thing. The temptation is to say, like, oh, we're all going to Jamaica. We're going to talk shit to Pat Kelsey. We're going to exercise all these demons. It's going to be such a delightful time. We're going to have stories to tell for years. We're going to be internet heroes. That's the temptation. That's the fantasy. The reality is you're stuck in, like, Ocho Rios on a fucking second-rate resort waiting all day for college basketball where there's 750 fans, 68 of which are first relatives and friends of Pat Kelsey, and 7 of which are your acquaintances and sometimes friends from UMass Twitter. So the challenge becomes you hold the signs, you're talking a ton of shit at the game, you know, the first day when they're not even playing UMass and you're just taunting the shit out of him, and then you're like playing cards all night or whatever it is that's at the site. I don't know if it's a casino place or what. But here's the way these things play out. When it gets right down to it, these preseason tournaments, other than like maybe Maui, which is still small, but these preseason tournaments, other than maybe the couple games at Madison Square Garden, are incredibly small-time affairs. When I say small-time affairs, I don't mean to say that the games themselves mean less or insignificant. I mean, very often, particularly in the kind of second-rate events, i.e. the one we're in, it's called like the fucking Jimmy John. No, it's not even Jimmy John's. It's like some like mid-tier regional. I guarantee they aren't even play that, by the way. Like with the COVID stuff, like they're not going to Jamaica for a fucking tournament. I'll bet any amount of money to anyone on that. I'll give you great odds. But these like second tier, it's like, I don't even know what it's called. It's like the Big Mouth Sandwich Classic or some dumb shit. At these events, you are dealing with an environment where there are very, very few people. Like, I went to the Vegas games
in 15. My wife got me a 30th birthday gift. She flew me out to Vegas for, and I stayed with my buddy who some of you may have met at the A10 tournament last year, who's a professional sports gambler in Vegas, left a job at a elite consulting firm because he's his own man and he's the fucking man. I stayed at his place and I just killed it in Vegas. Had a great time. Never go to Vegas for 4 days though. Awful idea. Former co-host of this program, Andrew Callagy, was there. Friend of the show, Ray Pearson, was there. Ryan Bamford was there. And like, then a ton of Seth Berger's family was there. And I'm telling you, other than that, there was like 8 people for UMass. 12 people. I mean, a couple families, you know, like of coaches, you know, like it was. And you play in a 10,000 seat arena the first game against Clemson that first day. Clemson probably had 30 fans. Creighton rolled deep. Creighton had like, what the fuck are you going to do if you're like a rich person in Omaha? You're going to go to Vegas the week before Thanksgiving because why not? So they had a bunch of fans. I forget the fourth team. Fourth team was, I think, Rutgers. Nobody. No, maybe very few because they were trash then. My point is like 10,000 fans giving tickets away in the MGM because, no, you know, if you wanted to go to an event, they'll give you tickets. The first game against Clemson, there was maybe 80 fans in the arena. Like, 80. Fucking, Cal didn't even, Andrew Callagy, who went out to Vegas for it with his boys from UMass, didn't even go. He's like, we were at the tables. I think he rolled in for, like, the end of the second half, came the next night. Like, that's, so, my point is, you go to Jamaica, you're stuck on a resort with 250 Wake Forest fans, 75 UMass fans, and 50 first family members of Pat Kelsey, and you're in a different country, and you've been talking shit in some, like, tiny little gym, they're going to find you in the hotel, and shit's going to get ugly real quick. Like, whether you end up in Jamaican prison, or if you just get kind of, like, quasi-deported back to the U.S., I don't know, but I just can't imagine that would end well unless we coordinated it to the degree that there was, like, a solid 200 of us and we could roll in a pack as a just, you know, reckless internet syndicate prepared for war with whatever Cincinnati ghouls we encountered. But anyway, none of this is going to happen because Pat Kelsey didn't get the Wake Forest job because he's Pat Kelsey. Scott Perkins, UMass JSP. Should Chaz Williams' number go up on the wall? Captaining our squad to the dance grows more monumental every year. Now, you got to listen to the Freddie Riley episode, and we will put it out. What Freddie hinted at and what others have said would suggest, and what I observed to some degree, was that Chaz may not have always been the most accommodating teammate. Now, I think his force of personality and intensity and passion took this program to a completely new heights, and that he is, without question, the most significant guy to come through UMass in the years 2000 to 2000. Well, certainly in the years 2009 to 2019. Trey Mitchell just came in and I think will ultimately top Chaz in many ways. And I think he would probably be my next. But remember, Jim McCoy's number is not retired. Monty Mack's number is not retired. He got to tournaments. I mean, these guys got to tournaments. So I think there's certainly a case for it. But in the end, it was one NCAA tournament and they lost by 20. And that team ended 8-8. Now, I don't want to take anything away from Derek Kellogg's group that year and Chaz's group that year. But how you perform, you know, they never got even to an A-10 final.
and they lost the one tournament game they had by 20. So, yes, very impressive. And if in 15 years we haven't been back to the tournament, that's a real conversation I think we go back and have about Chaz. But right now, we need to see how this current group shakes out and what comes the next 3 or 4 or 5 years. And if there's nothing to speak of after that, I think then you can have a serious conversation about Chaz. Tim Robertson, Hyperreal Tim. When should we start choosing, preparing, testing our outfits to wear to the first home game? I mean, you could start testing right now. Should they all be black? Not necessarily, no. Does Trey stay after this year, courtesy of the White Walker?
I don't think he transfers after this year. I think he wants to graduate, from what I've been told. But he could have such a dominant season that he's NBA ready. And that's a decision he'll have to make. But I'm going to say no. Narrowly no, but you never know. That's all I had from last week that was relevant. And anything else? Nope, that's it. That's it. Peace. This girl from my past, that ridiculous ass. She attended UMass and she passed every class. Walked down the hall with a stuck up sass. Talk to basketball players, she like how they pass. But when I used to hit it, the ball catch, she quit it. She wouldn't admit it, but shorty was addicted. Say word.